It's pick-click give time for Alaskans. When you file for the Alaska Permanent Fund dividend, you can support your favorite nonprofit organizations. Do you value public radio? Donations help KDLL provide the news, features, and entertainment programming you trust from around the world and right here at home. Apply for your dividend at pfd.alaska.gov by March 31st and pick-click give to help your favorite organizations. Thanks. This is listener-supported public radio for the Central Kenai Peninsula. KDLL 91.9 FM, Kenai, Soldotna. I'm Jenny Nyman. Have you ever learned a lesson the hard way? Or maybe not learned one at all? You are not alone. True Tales Told Live held a storytelling event February 2nd at Odie's Deli in Soldotna on the theme Lessons Not Learned. True Tales events invite local people to tell a true story on a designated theme, live in front of an audience, with no notes in a certain time frame. In this session, we had tales from Glenn Tinker, Bonnie Bernard, Vicky Tinker, Kat Sorensen, Joe Spady, Elizabeth Earle, Sally Cassano, Joel Todd, Joy Petrie, and Emily Knight. Caitlin Vodla and myself were the MCs. We don't have time in this hour to air everyone, so tune in next Saturday at 11 a.m. for more True Tales Told Live. And you can find podcast versions of our storytelling events on the KDLL website, kdll.org, under the podcast tab on the homepage, or on the True Tales program page. Let's get to the stories. We are going to jump right into the stories. We have a record here at True Tales. We have eight people. Well, actually more than eight people since we have a group effort, but we have eight storytellers on the agenda tonight. We are very excited about that. I think this is also a record crowd, so yay you and yay us. And yay our first storyteller, Mr. Glenn Tinker. I think one of the primary reasons, if not the only reason, that Glenn wanted to do this is because he knew somebody would buy him a beer, so we got that covered. I asked him how he wanted to introduce himself, and he just kind of blinked at me a lot and said, well, I have three kids. That's about all I've ever done, which is not true. Yeah. So Glenn, of course, local surveyor, has been in the Soldotna area since 1974. Yes. And in the Fairbanks area before that, which I believe is where his story tonight will start. He says he also started attending the University of Alaska Fairbanks and is about a junior now, college credit wise. So we'll be looking forward to the story of his graduation soon too. All right, Glenn, take it away.
I was going to write this book. It started back before I moved to Soldotna. I built a cabin near the mouth of the Taklanika River, and I had all my childhood dreams out there. I had the cabin, had a dog team, had a wife, had an infant daughter, and I had a cat, a kitten. You have to have a mouser. And in that cabin, it was home. I mean, the first time in my life I had a home. You could, you know, the dogs, when you'd get near home, they sense home, and they'd pick it up. They finally pull for the first time in the day. And then I'd go around the bend and see the kerosene lamp, see the light coming from the window, and it was home. And well, in the morning when I'd hook up the dogs, this cat would get on the kitten, really, get on the window ledge and just got excited, so excited. I mean, you could tell that he wanted to be a dog. He wanted to be hooked up. He wanted to be on that team. He wanted to be out there. And well, in Thanksgiving Day in 1974, we moved here to the peninsula. But I always thought about that. That was the best time of my life, and I wanted to write that story. And I was going to write it from the perspective of the kitten trapped, the cat who wanted to be a sled dog. And in my mind, I had the book and I had all these the illustrations of how we did things there for trapping. And But then I thought, well, I put it off. I thought, well, you know, that'd be a little presumptuous. I'd only been in Alaska 3 years. I was only off the road system for 3 years. And, you know, how could I write an Alaskan book? And then, but then later on, I learned that that's a respected Alaska tradition. But I found this book by James Michener. James Michener's Alaska. He came to Sitka for 8 months. And then later, we actually met a famous author right over here at BJ's. His name was Peter Jenkins. He said he was famous. He wrote A Walk Across America. So he was here, and he was he kind of headquartered in Seward for 6 months, and he wrote this book. I haven't read it, but I do recommend it because chapter two is called Ted, and that's really, it's about Ted Spraker, our local retired now biologist, and former Mayor Dale Bagley's picture is in there from it. It talks about his bear bite, and so really those were just excuses. I was kind of putting off writing this book, and then in 1986 the clincher came. You know, this Johnny come lately dog musher, her name was Libby Riddles. She was the first woman of the opposite sex to win the Iditarod. Well, she wrote my book. She wrote Danger the Dog Yard Cat, about this cat who dreamed about, you know, leading the sled dogs. In her story, he actually did. He was the lead dog that took him into Nome for won the Iditarod. And actually, her story was a lot better. And in the original one, there was a cassette tape that came with it, and she and Shelley Gill did beautiful music. So, but it was my story, and I'd put it off. And but then later, like I said, in 1974, we moved back here, and and things changed. Out there, my infant daughter, she was so excited when I came home, you know, after being trapping all day and started pulling the layers off of the overheated cabin. She would just get so excited, sort of like the cat, only more so. But then a few years back here in civilization, when she got to be a preteen, that went away. And that was the time she graduated from So High in 1991, and that was that time when it was, Paul Harvey said that Soldotna had the highest high school birth rate in the nation. So somehow I got all, I took this religion, this, I always forget that word. What is it?
Legalism.
Legalist, yeah. But the whole idea was to, you know, to keep my daughters from having sex. I mean, that was the rules. That's what it was about. It was, and I was such a clueless parent. So I thought, well, you know, if you just go to these church parties, you know, everything is cool. I mean, oh, I was so dumb. But so then after she made it, I was really proud she made it out of here without getting pregnant. She went off to college, but then she wrote me this letter home that about. Oh, how clueless I was, and you know, really, love would have been better than rules. And I understood that. And so then in my mind, the story was going to be Jessica from the Teklanika. I was going to talk about her baby days, and then all the things that I did wrong as a parent. And I was, this was all in my mind. But then, just recently, I found this, you know. I thought, I mean, I put off writing. I thought, who would buy a book about Soldotna? I mean, really. But then this book is called The Ocean in My Eyes by Megan McVie. I don't have my glasses on, but the first words of the first chapter are, it says, fornication, says Pastor Dan, is not just having sex out of marriage. But on and on it goes in it. Her parents, the heroine's parents, are me. I mean, she just nailed me, just being so stupid. And so, like one of her boyfriends meets her parents in the story, and he's so cool. And I remember the guy saying, "Well, I'll take such good care of your daughter, Mr. Tinker," and shook my hand. And several hours later, we got the call from I needed to bail her out of. But so the lesson not learned for me was that I had these two stories that I didn't write them, and somebody else did. I mean, it was a little different. And I found that my child rearing technique of, you know, don't do what I do, or I would set the example of what not to do, and that's worked well. And so that's what I would do tonight. I know that in this room right now there's someone, probably more than one, somebody who has a story in their heart that if they write, right, it'll change. Well, it'll change the world. It'll change some people. And I want to buy the book and have you autograph it. Thank you.
Thanks, Glenn. Okay, Bonnie sent me an introduction, which I asked her to do, but I'm not going to read it because I, for a long time, never wrote Bonnie's last name. I just wrote Bonnie the Botanist. And I had to ask someone what her last name was because when I met her, I asked her what she was interested in, and she said, plants. Bonnie is a recent transplant to Sterling with her flatmate and yurt mate, Tim, and I feel really lucky to have these cool young people move to our town and been hanging out with Bonnie. She likes to play in the snow, and she's a great addition to this community, and we're really lucky to have her, and she's bravely coming up here to tell a story, and without further introduction, Bonnie Bernard.
So I'm here this evening to tell you guys all in a roundabout sort of way a story about my dysfunctional relationship with cups or coffee mugs or mason jars or drinking vessels in general, really. And this problem began when I was young. I was sort of a bookish kid, and you could generally find me curled up reading, and I would usually have a cup or a mug of something in my hands. And the contents didn't really matter so much. What mattered is that I had something to occupy my hands while I was hyper-focused on whatever it was that I was reading. And I say hyper-focused not as hyperbole, but really, because as soon as I would set that cup or mug down, it effectively ceased to exist to me. And so this had the net effect that on my nightstand and my dresser and my headboard, cups would accumulate by the dozens until there were none left in the cupboard for anyone else in my family to use. And at this point, my mom would usually raid my room and recover the cups, and there would be scolding and dishwashing, and the cycle would begin anew. This very flattering habit went on well into college, and fast forward decade and a half to the early part of my professional career, and not much had changed about my relationship to cups, except that now they're almost exclusively coffee mugs, and they were accumulating on my desk rather than on my headboard. But something else had changed, and that was my ability to hyper-focus in on things the way six-year-old Bonnie did. At the time, I was working for the University of Alaska up in Anchorage doing plant research, more or less, as Caitlin's intro might have given you a hint about. And I was trying to write this chapter of a big assessment, more or less summarizing changes in wildfire dynamics in the boreal, which if you're a nerd like me, that's super cool to you. And I say trying because while I still had moments of hyperfocus like six-year-old Bonnie did, there were increasingly hours and sometimes days where it felt as though I couldn't read at all, almost. Like, the feeling was akin to the one that you get when you're reading a book at night and you read the same paragraph over and over because your eyes are passing over the words and like you're kind of getting it, but the meaning isn't sticking. And it was sort of a terrifying feeling, right? Like, as somebody who grew up very much loving reading, feeling as though my reading comprehension was disintegrating, it was a little unsettling. And so I dealt with it by not really dealing with it, actually. I didn't really address it for a while. And the problem never got better, and my anxiety about the problem continued to get worse until I swallowed my pride and went to see a doctor. And to my great pleasure. The doctor was very warm and open, and we got around to the, like, can you describe the primary reason for being in my office today part? And the conversation became very warm and like a dialogue. And he began to ask me like these very intimate and insightful questions the way an old friend might ask you insightful questions about a problem you were describing. And suddenly all amidst all that fear and anxiety, like a little bubble of hope like swelled inside me. Like this person was clearly invested in my getting better. And the tone of his voice didn't suggest that I had a neurological disorder or a brain tumor. So like there was a lot of relief there too. And then his questions ended and he promptly diagnosed me with like super mega ultra adult ADHD, which is a thing apparently. So all of those insightful questions were actually a DSM panel, and I had scored like 30 out of 30, like overachiever, like there's no ambiguity in this diagnosis. So what did I do? I also resisted that for a while because like I knew that I was sort of a cerebral person who lived in my head, but I didn't think of myself as spacey, right? And I knew that I had a hard time sitting still or like sitting at all, actually. But I didn't think of myself as flaky or unreliable. But eventually I started doing my research because, as we probably all know, the sort of pop culture interpretation of anything surrounding mental illness is usually not what it's actually like to live with mental illness. And the more that I read and researched, the more I came to understand that I wasn't being asked to change the parts about myself that I liked. There was nothing wrong with the fact that I had a lot of diverse interests. The dysfunctional part was feeling so overwhelmed by all the things that I wanted to do that I never made headway on any of them. And it was sort of weird that I was a person who read 3 books at once, but that was fine. The dysfunctional part came in when I never really finished 2 out of 3 of them because I would start on book 4 before I ever finished book 1. And I couldn't really argue with that. I had to concede that. And so I did, and I started making progress toward those sort of bigger picture things. Like, I learned how to work past the overwhelm. So fast forward a couple more years, and I am packing up my office in Anchorage because I'm leaving that job and I'm moving down here to the peninsula. And almost everything is in boxes, my books and my pictures. And all that remains is this one drawer under my desk. And I'm feeling good, I'm feeling nostalgic. I'm reflecting on all the lessons that I have successfully learned over the years about academia and professionalism and myself, right? Feeling good. And feeling good, I lean down to open this last drawer and put it in a box, and lo and behold, in this drawer is something on the order of 12 coffee mugs. And guys, I knew that like I would occasionally squirrel a mug away into this drawer when it was really cluttered and I didn't feel like cleaning the whole desk, or like when a coworker would knock and I didn't really want to admit the extent of my caffeine dependency, but I didn't realize it was that bad. And so here I was. I had clearly made progress on the big picture, but I still had some small picture things to work on. So I'd like to wrap this up on an upbeat angle, which is to say that I think the broader lesson here is pretty well summarized by that last little anecdote, which is to say that metaphorically, every time we take that cup off of the desk and we squirrel it away into some unseen drawer, we miss an opportunity to learn. And it's only by opening that drawer and looking at the mess and taking it out into broad daylight and doing the office walk of shame into the community kitchen and busting all 12 of those mugs for everyone to see that we actually begin to learn. Thanks.
Bonnie the Botanist. I'm even worse at names than Caitlin, so I don't even really think I'm ever going to even try to commit a last name to memory, because Bonnie the Botanist is so awesome. So up next we have Vicky Tinker. If the last name sounds familiar, this is because Vicky is Glenn's wife, although not the wife that was mentioned in his story, we should point out. She works for Frontier Community Services. She's also a local musician, as I'm sure many of you are familiar with her in that realm.
And as you are about to hear, she is a devoted volunteer of standing outside in the winter. So if any of you have a volunteer job that involves just standing outside in the winter, Vicky is your gal.
I did not anticipate that there would be several people here that were probably at this event, and so that either makes it awkward or fun. I'm not sure which, so here we go. So the Halloween of 2007 was bitterly cold, and I remember this because Katie Evans and I were standing out in it. And we were standing out in it because our family had recently joined a new church, and it was cool, man. They did all these exciting activities for in the community to just love on people and without another agenda, you know, just to do fun stuff with them. And so we were all in, and we volunteered for everything. And we were a little bit indiscriminate about it. And so Katie and I show up at the Glow in the Dark event on Halloween. And we say, yeah, just we'll do anything. And so we were assigned to be the greeters. And so it was our job to stand outside and greet everybody that came. Everybody else was inside, you know, there was all kinds of activities going on, but we were outside. And then the specific instruction was that we were to greet people who, you know, non-church people, just be extra friendly to them. So we, sure, you know. And then we're standing out there in the cold and we realize we're new. We have no idea who goes. And so we thought, we're going to try our magical heathen meters and see. And mine's kind of broken because I see Jesus in everybody and Katie has no heathen meter at all. So I don't remember whether we treated everyone as guests or everyone as family, but I know that it was so bitterly cold out that by the end of the evening, they were all heathens, and the person who gave that job was going straight down the chute to hell. So a year went by, and you would think that we'd have learned that lesson, but we did not. And so we show up again at the Glow in the Dark. Hey, give us a job to do, we'll do it. And so we got assigned to be in charge of the bouncy house. And what could be more fun than a bouncy house? Well, it turns out anything, pretty much. And it was it was another bitterly cold night. And you know, you're standing around, it's not like you're moving much. So we were out there and everybody else is inside. There's face painting and there's food and there's games and cakewalks and prizes and candy and wah, you know, and we're out there in the cold. And, you know, every once in a while some kid would trudge out like with 20 layers on and kind of flop himself into the bouncy house and lose a snow boot and kind of cry and trudge back inside without even saying anything. And, you know, another victim had come out and this kind of went on for, it just seemed like we were out there forever. It was so cold. So we thought, hey, we'll bounce in the bouncy house. We'll get warm by bouncing in the bouncy house. So we take off our shoes and we like jump in there, only it's not bouncy. It's like being in a jar of marshmallow cream or something. It just kind of sucks you in, and we had to like roll to the edge and flop ourselves out. And so that was a bust, and and a couple kids came out and did the same thing, and then somebody's grandpa came out.
Well, you know that these things won't stay inflated at 0 degrees, and you ought to know that.
And so I was like, all right, thanks, grandpa. And so we decided we're just going to, you know, this event's going to be done in 45 minutes. Let's just deflate it now. We'll get it all flattened out and folded up and back in its package, and we won't have to stay late. So we grabbed a couple other people, and we had fun, you know, bouncing on it and rolling on it, and we got it pretty much all the way flat. And I'm just laying there going, ooh, it kind of felt good because I've been standing up for so long. And then the spirit of stupid floated over me, and I said, I know, why don't you guys wrap me up in this? And so, yeah, let's do that. And so So this very, very huge bouncy castle thing, and they like wrap me up, roll, and I'm all in there, ha, ha. And then I'm in there, and the spirit of stupid departs, and my keen awareness realizes that I'm claustrophobic. I can't, there's no air in here, and it's like not breathable fabric. I mean, it's like this heavy canvas, and I couldn't reach my cell phone if I wanted to, and I'm kind of stuck. And so I scream, and nobody hears me. And I try to thrash around a little bit, like, and nothing. And I scream again, and I kind of hear a little bit of laughter. And so I scream again, and then somebody sits on me. And I scream again, and so they're on my head, and they bounce again. And so now I'm kind of panicking and realizing that none of my efforts so far, that they've all come to naught, right? So I think, what would Jenny do in an ice cave, right? This was before that. So I'm going to be really calm. I'm just going to chill. So, this is how it ends. When peace like a river attendeth my way, when sorrows like sea billows roll, whatever my lot thou hast taught me to say, it is well with my soul. But it was not well with my soul. And I really, really panicked then because I could, and I just thrashed and screamed as much as I could. And I heard them running toward me, and they got it, right? So they unraveled me, and I just lay there and my heart pounding in my ears. We all survived that. I don't even remember. Nicole, were you part of that? Did you sit on my head? It was probably her. Anyway. We survived. And so I learned that lesson very well. So I have learned a few lessons. One, I'm a little more choosy about my volunteering these days. I have like some parameters, right? But I still volunteer too much. And I dress better for cold weather. And I will never, ever, ever volunteer to be rolled up in a bouncy house.